When the two ships close to within 500 yards, the women on board the larger vessel throw off their clothes and start running, only they are not running like women. And in a moment, they muscle a wood-colored tarp off the sides of their ship, revealing an additional 24 cannons. Dozens of men rush up from the decks of the larger ship, some to guard posts, others to masts, still others to the stern. And in a sudden and screaming ballet, they trim sails so that the large ship now knifes through the sea, making white foam as she hurtles toward the smaller merchant ship. The merchant captain yells for his crew, and then he sees what he has spent his career dreading. The onrushing ship lowers its English flag and hoists a new one, blood red and emblazoned with an hourglass. This is a pirate flag. The hourglass makes a warning. If you resist, your remaining time on Earth will be short and bloody. The merchant captain orders his men to their guns. Before they can act, the pirates fire a cannon. The seas explode, a thunder so loud it seems to collapse the skies, and out of a billowing cloud of gray smoke, a 6-pound black iron ball screams over the bow of the merchant ship, a preview of what is to come if they fail to surrender. The smell of burning sulfur fills the air. It takes minutes for the smoke to clear, but when it does, the pirate ship is just 300 yards away and closing fast. Now the merchant captain can see pirates streaking up from the holds, 20 at a time, until more than 100 line the decks, screaming and waving swords and firing muskets into the sky. The merchant captain's instinct is to flee, but he is heavy with cargo and slow. Still, if he could run for just a few hours, he might slip away under cover of night. It was always hope in the night. He orders his crew to speed away, to get the ship moving for all she's worth, but no matter how fast she sails, the pirate ship stays with her, gaining with every maneuver. Now just 200 yards away, the pirate captain finally shows himself, stepping onto his bow, dressed in gray breeches and tan waistcoat, a heavy gold chain around his neck. Calling into a speaking tube, he demands that the merchant captain surrender or face the fires of hell. The merchant captain now must decide whether to fight. A single well-placed shot from one of his cannons could stop the pirates. Two might destroy them. But if he fails, he knows how the rest would unfold. He has heard accounts of pirate attacks since boyhood. The pirates would fire their cannons at his masts in order to disable but not ruin his ship and her cargo. They would strafe his decks with musket fire, looking to kill and maim as many crew as possible. As they drew closer, they would hurl shrapnel-filled cast-iron hand grenades, fire-starting bombs, and flaming stink pots, a rancid concoction of rotting animal flesh, tar and pitch, and other putrid ingredients. Some of these fireworks would kill or disable his crew. Others would blanket his ship in smoke. When the pirates got just a few yards away, they would use grappling hooks, swords, axes, pikes, and pistols to fight off defenders and pull the ships close. Swarming onto the merchant ship, they would hack and shoot, slash and bite anyone who resisted them. Even if the merchant captain and his crew fought well, it usually ended badly for captains who chose to fight pirates. And that was if the captain was lucky enough to die in the fight. If he survived, the pirates might boil him alive, cut out and eat his still beating heart, pull out his tongue, crush his skull until his eyeballs disgorged, hang him by his genitalia, throw dice for the privilege of chopping off his head. If a merchant captain surrendered peacefully, however, the pirates might set him and his crew free, invite them to join their crew, even return the ship. Nothing, however, was guaranteed, which was the pirate's most terrifying quality of all. "Answer, dogs!" the pirate captain orders, his men training their cannons and muskets on the merchant ship. The merchant captain has no more time for thought. By surrendering, he places his own life and the lives of his crew in the hands of madmen. But he also can count. The pirates outnumber him 3-1. They have 30 cannons. He has 6. He remembers the stories he heard growing up. So, as do most merchant captains in his position, he puts down his guns and surrenders. The pirates board, and the merchant captain and his crew are made prisoner, chained together on the deck. None is surprised when the pirates relieve them of their clothing and valuables, then plunder the ship of its cargo. But the crew is startled to hear the pirate captain address them directly.
"Speak up plain, lads. What treatment from your captain have you?"
For a time, the merchant crew stays silent. Then, one by one, they begin to tell the pirates about their captain. When they finish, the pirate captain walks up to his counterpart.
"And so, sir," he says, "the same shall happen to you."
"John?"
Matera's heart pounded at the sound of his name. Ready to meet his own fate, he looked up to face the pirate captain. Instead, he saw Carolina, bleary-eyed and in her negligee.
"It's 2 a.m,
she said.
"I'm researching. Is it really that late?"
"Yes, really. Can you make room for me?"
Sitting cross-legged on the dining room floor of his Santo Domingo apartment, Matera was surrounded on all sides by piles of books and papers on pirates. It had been a week since his trip to see the oracles in Florida, and he'd done little but study pirate history since then.
"Come here, my pirate princess," he said.
He pushed aside a pile of books and pulled Carolina into his circle. He described the pirate attack he'd just envisioned, pieced together from these resources. He'd known tough guys in his life, some of them legends, but few came close to these men. Even pirates, Carolina said, needed sleep, so she insisted that Matera hang it up for the night. Since he'd begun this phase of his research, he'd spent every evening working past midnight. Matera took a quick shower, brushed his teeth, and put on his boxer shorts and t-shirt. In bed, he kissed Carolina goodnight and waited for sleep. And waited. He turned onto his side and adjusted his pillow. He flipped onto his other side and pushed down a sheet.
"Maybe he needed a drink of water, John," Carolina said. "I was wondering if you're not too tired to talk. What's so interesting about these pirates?"
Matera smiled and sat up in the bed.
"You really want to know?"
"Mm-hmm."
"Then listen to this."
Pirates were born in ancient times. On the day men first loaded cargo onto ships, or maybe the day before. They came from Greece and Rome, China and North Africa, and almost every other country on the map. Bandits of 1,000 eras who sailed with a single purpose, to steal everything they could from ships too lightly defended or too terrified to fight. The pirates Matera cared about came from a special time and place. They hunted prey on the Caribbean and the Atlantic from the mid-17th century to the early 18th century, the golden age of piracy. It was these men who swashbuckled and plundered in the books and movies of generations, and who haunted and thrilled the dreams of youngsters. It was these men whom Bannister commanded. They flourished for much of the 17th century, taking prizes and striking terror into the hearts of merchant seamen, especially the Spanish, who controlled much of the trade and shipping in the Caribbean and Atlantic. Many countries considered the pirates to be the scourge of mankind. England loved them. By harassing Spanish ships, pirates made room for English trade and expansion. In the bargain, pirate ships took hard and violent men off the streets and put them to work, then brought back stolen goods to English markets and sold them on the cheap. Pirates spent handsomely to outfit their ships and paid generous bribes to English officials. They drained their purses in port like men just days away from the gallows, which many of them were. If England shook her fist at these rogues, she did so with fingers crossed, bulging coffers, and an eye toward expanding her empire. Many of the pirates got rich. If Spanish seamen happened to be terrorized or killed in the bargain, few in England seemed heartbroken about that. And the pirates could bring the terror. In a letter to the Secretary of State, one English witness wrote, "It is a common thing among the privateers to cut a man in pieces. First some flesh, then a hand, an arm, a leg, sometimes tying a cord about his head, and with a stick, twisting it until the eyes shoot out, which is called woulding." Another described the methods of a notorious French pirate. "Lolonais grew outrageously passionate, insomuch that he drew his cutlass and with it cut open the breast of one of those poor Spanish
and pulling out his heart with his sacrilegious hands, began to bite and gnaw it with his teeth, like a ravenous wolf, saying to the rest, "I will serve you all alike, if you show me not another way." The years following the English conquest of Jamaica were glorious for pirates and privateers, who preyed almost at will on Spanish shipping. Even Spanish towns weren't safe from these marauders, who were capable of assembling forces of 1,000 or more and invading places thought to be impregnable. Often the Spanish could do little but surrender and pray for mercy. In Port Royal, gold and silver spilled out of the taverns and brothels onto the streets. The golden age of piracy had dawned. And with it came great captains, men of charisma and vision, who schemed on the grandest scales. None dreamed bigger or led more men than Welshman Henry Morgan, who launched a series of great invasions against the Spanish. In just 4 years, he led rough and wild crews, sometimes by the thousands, on raids against Portobello, Maracaibo, and in one of the great military triumphs of the age, Panama. For this, he became exceedingly wealthy and a hero in both Port Royal and England. Stories of Morgan's ruthlessness were legion. One witness reported that when a prisoner refused to cooperate, Morgan's men strapadoed him until both his arms were entirely dislocated, then knotted a cord so tight round the forehead that his eyes bulged out big as eggs. Since he still would not admit where the coffer was, they hung him up by his mail parts, while one struck him, another sliced off his nose, yet another an ear, and another scorched him with fire, tortures as barbarous as man can devise. At last, when the wretch could no longer speak, and they could think of no new torments, they let a negro stab him to death with a lance. When another man refused to talk, they tied long cords to his thumbs and his big toes and spread-eagled him to four stakes. Then four of them came and beat on the cords with their sticks, making his body jerk and shudder and stretching his sinews. Still not satisfied, they put a stone weighing at least 200 weight on his loins and lit a fire of palm leaves under him, burning his face and setting his hair alight. For every person who witnessed such horrors, 1,000 more heard about them. Reputation became the pirate's sharpest sword. For a time it seemed as if the glory years for pirates might last forever. By 1670, however, new economic winds were blowing in the Caribbean and Atlantic. Legitimate trade had become increasingly profitable to the merchant and ruling classes. Uncertainty on the high seas and in the shipping lanes was bad for business, and was putting the fortunes of powerful merchants, and even England herself, at risk. And there were no greater purveyors of uncertainty at sea than the pirates and privateers. In 1670, England and Spain signed the Treaty of Madrid. Among other things, it called for England to condemn piracy. No more privateer licenses, no more safe havens, no more markets for stolen Spanish goods. In return, Spain made concessions to English trade and shipping. The treaty provided England with new commercial opportunities, some big enough to grow an empire. But they required peaceful and predictable seas. English officials shook fists and swore vows to eradicate the pirates, but through the 1670s, little meaningful action was taken. Pirates still had deep roots in the Caribbean and continued to supply locals with cheap goods, contraband, and a steady flow of income. To great swaths of the population, especially the commoners, the pirates remained the good guys. And they were getting better at their craft. By 1680, pirates were causing great disruption to the legitimate trade moving into and out of Jamaica. The governor called for Royal Navy warships. By 1683, they had arrived, four in all, including the Ruby, a 125-foot giant killer that could carry 48 cannons and a crew of 150. She anchored at Port Royal and would be directed by Governor Thomas Lynch, who had been charged with destroying the pirate scourge. But it would take more than just the hoisting of sails for these warships to take on this enemy. More than 1,200 pirates were thought to be operating out of Port Royal alone. They had faster ships, could slip into shallower waters, knew the waterways and inlets and escape routes better, and had more experienced captains. and the pirates knew they would hang if they were caught. Still, the sheer power of the Navy frigates was enough to scare many pirates away. To those who remained, the rows of cannons aboard the Navy ships anchored in sight of Port Royal spoke a simple truth. We are the hunters now. You are the prey. It is just a matter of time before we catch you, and when we do, you will die. Governor Lynch sent the warships into heavy patrol, not just around Jamaica, but to Hispaniola, Cuba, and other pirate strongholds. Often, the frigates returned empty-handed, but with every cruise they gained experience and savvy. Soon, they were catching pirates, most of whom chose to surrender rather than risk annihilation in battle. Pirates continued to flee from Port Royal and other safe havens. For those who remained, the prospect of the gallows loomed larger than ever. Every month, it seemed, England got better at exterminating these rogues of the sea. Nevertheless, if a man were willing to go up against the Royal Navy, defy the will of a nation, spit in the face of wealthy merchants and plantation owners, give the middle finger to a governor, and sail in a world increasingly hostile to his kind, he might still make a fortune as a Caribbean pirate. To do it in 1684, however, he would need to be better than good, and brave in exceptional measure. And that was when Bannister made his move, Matera said. He had everything, Carolina. Respect, admiration, money, a future. He risked it all to turn pirate. Why would he do that? His fiancée didn't answer. Carolina? Matera could tell by her breathing she'd fallen asleep. Reaching over, he pulled up her covers and kissed her cheek. There was something calling to Bannister, he said, rolling over and putting his head on his pillow. It was more than money or power. There was something else going on with this guy. The more Matera learned about pirates, the more interesting he found their portrayal in Hollywood films and popular culture. Some things the movies depicted were true, others were fantasy, and still others were rarely shown. Pirates, for example, were not known to make prisoners walk the plank. They found it easier to kill a man by hacking him with a sword or shooting him and then throwing him overboard. No theatrics required. And they never buried treasure or made maps leading to it. They spent their money, often as fast as they could steal it. But they did love parrots and taught them to talk and kept them as pets during voyages. And they went into battle carrying as many weapons as possible, not to look cool, but because guns of the day often misfired and took time to reload. Matera loved the language of the pirates, and even found a book dedicated to the subject. Pirates never said, "Arr," or "Shiver me timbers," which almost certainly originated, like so much supposed pirate language, in Hollywood movies from the 1950s. They did use terms and phrases such as ahoy, a merry life and a short one, and several curses, oaths, threats, and greetings, each of which Matera enjoyed. He scribbled down these favorites to yell at Chatterton when next he saw him. Eat what falls from my tail. Damn your blood. I'll cleave your skull asunder. I'll cut you in pound pieces. I come from hell, and I'll carry you there presently. Some other things Matera had learned from the movies turned out to be true as well. Pirates employed hooks and wooden legs as prosthetics, and patches to cover eye sockets, often for injuries suffered in battle. They wore a range of outfits, from the drab and practical to the most fanciful flourishes of gold, crimsons, blues, and reds, including feathers, gold chains, silk shirts, and velvet trousers. Often their get-ups depended less on sartorial instinct than what they'd recently stolen. And they swore, drank, gambled, and womanized as if any night might be their last. "Whenever they have got hold of something, they don't keep it for long," wrote one contemporary observer. "They are busy dicing, whoring, and drinking so long as they have anything to spend. Some of them will get through a good 2,000 or 3,000 pieces of eight in a day, and next day not have a shirt to their back." Matera had known guys like that growing up. Pirate views on race and gender fascinated Matera. Black people sailed often on pirate ships during the Golden Age. In fact, black sailors often composed a large minority of men on board. Their status, however, depended on the time. Early in the Golden Age, black men aboard pirate ships were more likely to be slaves, either working as such or as prisoners captured from ships and to be traded at market. Later in the era, however, many black men aboard pirate ships, perhaps even most of them, were full-fledged pirates with all the rights and privileges of their white counterparts. They led charges into combat, earned equal pay, stood side by side with Blackbeard himself during battle, all 150 years before slaves became free in the United States. But for all the racial equality, pirates almost never sailed with women. Just four or five are known to have worked as pirates during the Golden Age. Two of them, Mary Read and Anne Bonny, became famous, dressing as men and fighting alongside one of the most celebrated of all pirate captains, Calico Jack Rackham. Almost without exception, pirates viewed the presence of women aboard their ships as a distraction and a potential source of conflict and jealousy. On some pirate ships, the penalty for secreting a woman aboard was death. Matera could not get enough of these men. He absorbed pirate customs, cataloged their weapons, diagrammed their ships. All the while, he marveled at their criminal instincts. Wherever he looked, he saw Gambino in them. Like the gangsters Matera had known growing up, the pirates worked to avoid violence and fighting. It wasn't because they were frightened, they weren't, or believed they couldn't win. They almost always had bigger crews, stronger fighters, and better weapons than their prey. It was because bloodshed was bad for business. A battle at sea could result in casualties, ruin plunder, even cost the pirates their own ship. It also attracted the attention of the law. To steal quietly always paid best. Most pirate victims understood whom they were dealing with and gave up on the spot. For their cooperation, they often were treated fairly, even generously. But there were also those who, for money or principle or pride, tried to flee or put up a fight. That's when the pirates rained down their particular brand of terror, one designed to echo across oceans. By squeezing a man's eyes from their sockets, roasting him on a baking stone, or extracting and eating his still beating heart, pirates did more than punish resistors or force them to turn over hidden booty. They also sent a message to the rest of the world. Do not struggle against us. We are crazy. It always ends better if you just go along. To guarantee they were heard, they often spared a lucky few, sending them home to spread the terrible word. Not every pirate captain tortured or punished resistors so cruelly, but enough of them did it enough of the time that by the 17th century the only weapon a pirate often needed was the design sewn into his flag. Unmistakable even at great distances, it announced not a fait accompli, but that a choice was at hand. Matera lost himself in these stories. Still, he was looking for something even deeper about pirates, for an insight into their lives. So he began asking a different kind of question, one he'd posed to every interesting person he'd met since he was a boy. How did you get here? The voices that began sounding from inside his books began to tell a singular story. A young Englishman of the late 17th century might expect to earn his living as a farmer or carpenter or baker. If he were good with his hands, he might become a tailor or a smith. But if he had a strong constitution and an appetite for adventure, he could step off the end of his country and find work on one of the many merchant ships that carried cargo and passengers to a world that was expanding by the day. A merchant seaman visited strange lands, stared down nature, saw places and creatures his peers could scarcely imagine. In the process, he learned to become a first-rate mariner, able to navigate treacherous waters and find his way by the stars. It could be the hardest of lives. Often the work was backbreaking, the conditions miserable, and the pay barely enough to survive. Perhaps worst of all, merchant captains exercised absolute authority over their crews, often treating them brutally and holding back what little salary they earned. If anyone objected, and even when they did not, the captain might whip, torture, imprison, or starve them. Much of this treatment was protected by Admiralty law, which granted a captain near autocratic power over his crew. Such laws were deemed necessary to maintain order and profitability aboard the ships. But such unchecked authority opened doors to abuse and created a legion of predators at the helm. Aggrieved seamen might leave the trade, but those who desired to stay at sea had few options. One was to join the Navy, where provisions and pay were a bit better and the workloads more humane. Discipline, however, might be even more severe aboard a Navy ship, and there was always the chance a sailor might die in battle for a cause he might not agree with, or even understand. The other option lay in the shadows. It called to the daring, and it promised a far different life. To find it, a merchant sailor need only step to the other side of the harbor, to the other side of the world, to where the pirates lived, to the place where a common man could turn king. Many pirates became wealthy, earning hundreds or even thousands of times more than a merchant seaman, sometimes overnight. They formed large crews, often exceeding 100, making for easier workloads and more carefree environments. They chased adventure, became comrades, lived life on their terms. Cruelty by pirate captains was almost unknown. Of course, there were dangers to turning pirate, especially in the late 17th century. They risked life and limb on every voyage, and often hanged for their crimes. Still, if a man possessed a certain boldness, if he dreamed for himself glorious things, chancing the gallows made sense. By Bannister's time, nearly three-quarters of all pirates came from the ranks of the merchant seamen, strong young men adept at sea, tired of bad treatment, and with little to lose. That made them a formidable force before they ever left port. A gang of the angry who, on the right day and with the right leader, might even take on the Royal Navy. Of all Matera's pirate books, the one he loved most was the oldest and tiniest, The Buccaneers of America, written by one-time pirate Alexandre Excumelon, and first published in 1678. It was skinny enough to pocket, so he took it on a trip to the grocery store one morning with Carolina. Flipping through pages while Carolina inspected the produce, he found this sentence. When a ship has been captured, the men decide whether the captain should keep it or not. Carolina, he called. Siento, sorry, he said to startled customers, then made his way past the bananas and papayas until he could whisper in Carolina's ear. I think I've got it. I think I've found what I've been looking for. At his apartment, he tore through Excumelon and other books. He'd been through many of these volumes before, but always for the swashbuckling stuff. This time, he turned to the chapters on pirate organization and politics. He'd always presumed them to be the dreariest sections. From the moment he began reading, they opened his eyes. Before every voyage, pirates gathered together to commit an unthinkable act. They made every crewman an equal. From the greenest of lookouts to the captain himself, no one would own rights over any other or possess privileges unavailable to all. The men would eat the same meals, earn similar wages, share the same quarters. The captain would exercise absolute authority only in battle. At other times, he would guide the ship according to the pleasure of the crew. And that was just the start of the madness. Having made everyone equal, the pirates now put almost everything to a vote. To choose where to stalk prey, they voted. To decide whether to attack a target, they voted. To determine the rules of the ship, the punishment for wrongdoers, division of booty, to maroon or shoot traitors, they voted. And every man's vote counted the same. One might have expected these men, who lived lawless lives in the shadow of gallows, to cast their ballots in unpredictable ways. Yet time and again, through the decades that spanned their golden age, the pirates seemed to vote exactly alike. Matera could see the patterns right away. Using his orange highlighter, he began underlining rules that seemed to govern every pirate ship that sailed in the era. Captains were to earn no more than 2 or 3 times that of the lowliest deckhand. Every man was to have an equal share of food, liquor, and other provisions.
Battle injuries would be compensated according to body part. On one pirate ship, damages were paid as follows. Lost right arm, 600 pieces of silver or 6 slaves. Lost left arm, 500 pieces of silver or 5 slaves. Lost right leg, 500 pieces of silver or 5 slaves. Lost left leg, 400 pieces of silver or 4 slaves. Lost eye, either one, 100 pieces of silver or 1 slave. Lost finger, 100 pieces of silver or 1 slave. Internal injury, up to 500 pieces of silver or 5 slaves. Lost hook or peg leg, same as if original limb was lost. Anyone caught stealing from the ship's plunder would be punished, including by being marooned on an uninhabited island. Anyone caught cheating another crewman would have his ears and nose slashed by the aggrieved party, then turned out at the next port. No women were allowed on board. Anyone sneaking a woman onto the ship would be killed. Disputes between crewmen would be settled on shore by duel. Bonuses would be awarded for courage in combat, the sighting of prey, boarding a target ship first, and other heroics. Punishments would be inflicted for cowardice, drunkenness, insolence, disobedience, rape, and any other action that undermined the ship's primary purpose, to steal. Any unsettled issues would be put to a vote. Every man's vote carried equal weight. One after another, these ideas seemed incredible to Matera. He tried to imagine Paul Castellano accepting just 2 times the salary of the lowest Gambino foot soldier, or John Gotti taking the votes of street corner bookies. The criminal bosses Matera had known killed men who aspired to be their equal. Now, he was reading about pirate captains who wouldn't take an extra pig's foot for dinner and didn't get a cabin to themselves. Matera couldn't get enough of these captains. Each needed to be fearless in vision and unflinchingly brave, and willing to visit terror on targets that resisted attack, yet the captain served at the pleasure of his crew. He was elected by popular vote and could be deposed by the same. If he were too lenient or too cruel, too aggressive or too passive, if he refused to be guided by the will of the ship, he was out and might be punished, even marooned, for his failures. And this was true even if, like Bannister, he owned the ship. All of this had a thrilling ring to Matera. The votes, the equality, the absence of kings. This was democracy, a century before the concept took hold in America. To Matera, it made sense for a regular guy to turn pirate. But what of Bannister? He already had money, power, and autonomy. His future was made. By turning pirate, he risked all of that. And he risked his life. Before, Matera couldn't figure why a made guy would make such a leap, but he understood it now. There was freedom aboard these pirate ships, 100 or more men inflamed with the idea that anything was possible for anyone. Bannister might have been a gentleman, and he might have had his future ahead of him, but he'd likely never gotten inside a feeling like that. Matera could have kept reading forever, but he believed he had his answer. By week's end, he would rejoin Chatterton for their search for the Golden Fleece. But this time, things would be different. This time, they were going to look somewhere entirely new. Chapter 12. The Sugar Wreck. Gentlemen, we have direction. Presiding over a strategy breakfast he'd called at Tony's, Matera asked his teammates to imagine themselves back in the Golden Age, when the greatest and most daring pirates had made their names. "We need to think like them," he said. "If we can think like pirates, we can find them." That's when he started to talk about democracy. The pirates had sailed in the 17th century, but they were men ahead of their time. Professional lawbreakers who made inviolable laws for themselves. Matera read to the men from pirate constitutions, described their voting rights, and underlined their foundational idea, that any man might become rich if he dared, but that no man should ever become king.
His companions listened, rapt, throughout. Then they asked him, "How does this help us find the Golden Fleece?" Matera's answer was simple. It all came down to Bannister and his motivations. Bannister was more than a great pirate. To Matera, he was a man enthralled by democracy. No other motive so elegantly explained why a gentleman captain, likely in his 30s or 40s, and with a future secured, would risk everything to go plunder on the high seas. Maybe he loved money. Maybe he loved adventure. But he must have known one thing for sure. Men came alive when they were made equal. 100 of them together could take on the world. Yet, in the 1680s, as empires joined forces to drive pirates to the bottom of the sea, a man like Bannister couldn't be certain that democracy would survive, or even that future generations would know such an audacious idea had taken hold. To make people remember, he would need to do something epic, something history couldn't ignore. Pillaging more ships wouldn't cut it. Stockpiling treasure would leave no mark at all. But fighting the Royal Navy would have impact. Defeating them in battle would make equality echo through time. And that, Matera said, changed everything about how the team might search for the Golden Fleece. For 9 months, they'd been looking for the perfect place for a pirate ship to careen. Now, they would look for the perfect place for a pirate ship to fight. An area of land where Bannister had placed cannoneers and musketeers and waged a battle for the ages. Chatterton agreed.
Bannister believed, Chatterton said. He wasn't running from the Navy. He was waiting for them. If we find Bannister's battlefield, we find his ship nearby.
The four men laid out a map of Samana Bay on the table, but none could immediately point to an area they hadn't already searched. But that was just on paper.
Armed with new insight, they would return to their boats and start looking back toward the shores. Leaving the restaurant, Heiko Kretschmer pulled Matera aside and told him how moved he was by the pirate's story. At age 18, he'd risked his life fleeing East Germany, first by hopping a train to Czechoslovakia, then stowing away aboard another train bound for West Germany, likely never again to see his family, all for a taste of freedom and a chance to see the world. "In those days," Kretschmer said, "I dreamed about democracy." Chatterton and Matera combed the banks of Samana Bay for the next week. They found several potential battlefields, but none good enough for inspired pirates to make history in a stand against two Royal Navy warships. That weekend, Garcia Alacon threw a party at the villa. Chatterton was among the first to show up, a bottle of wine in each hand. He didn't intend to stay. He and Matera were scheduled to search the bay at 5:30 the next morning, but didn't argue when Garcia Alacon's wife pulled him inside and introduced him to guests. For the next several hours, he talked diving, recounting his adventures. Even as he laughed and described key moments, it all seemed like a lifetime ago to him now. When the party finally wound down, Chatterton grabbed a last glass of wine and stepped onto the veranda, where he stood under a bright moon, looking out over the channel. Matera joined him.
"What are we missing?" Chatterton asked.
Matera couldn't answer. He couldn't do anything but look out over the water. Then he put down his wine glass. "Get in the boat," he said. "Get Victor."
"It's 2 in the morning, Chatterton said.
"We need to go, now." 20 minutes later, the three men were in the Zodiac and heading across the channel to Cayo Vigia, a small island just 600 yards from the villa. Matera cut the engine and let the boat settle onto a sandbar by the island's northern hump.
"Holy shit," Chatterton said.
The men stood up in the boat and looked around. From every direction, the Zodiac remained hidden to the world.
"If I'm a pirate looking to careen, this is my place," Garcia Alacon said.
"And if I'm going to have a fight for the ages, I fight from right here," said Chatterton.
The three men took stock of the island. At most, it stretched 500 yards east to west, 100 yards north to south, yet the water was deep, about 25 feet, almost up to its beach. Its eastern end rose high above the water where cannon batteries could be camouflaged in dense overgrowth
and fired unseen at enemies. And it was less than a half mile to the mainland, where fresh water could be found. Matera could only chuckle. He and Chatterton had been looking at this island from the villa every day for the past 9 months. But it had never crossed their minds that a big sailing ship like the Golden Fleece might be capable of maneuvering in here. Yet, when one stood on the spot, it was clear that a large vessel could do that, if she were helmed by a man of daring and nerve. Even the smallest mistake or sudden current could force a big sailing ship to run aground. Matera began scribbling notes in his small leather notebook, but Chatterton held up his hand.
"Start the engine. We need to move," Chatterton said.
He pulled the cord and took the tiller, guiding the Zodiac from the island to a point about 125 yards off its northeastern tip.
"Guys," Chatterton announced, "we are now over the so-called sugar wreck."
The sugar wreck was a debris field worked for a few days by Carl Fismer in the mid-1980s. He'd learned of it from a Dominican treasure hunter whose family had owned land in Samana for centuries. When Fiz dove the site, he found a sugar urn, delicate and intact, that looked to have come from the late 1600s, hence the nickname Sugar Wreck. To him, it appeared that the urn and the scattered debris that spread for 100 yards around it might have come from a merchant ship, and since he was looking for treasure galleons at the time, he put the wreck on hold. Fiz didn't get back to the site before his lease in the area ended, but Bowden had done his own work there, recovering Delftware pottery, a pistol, cannonballs, medicine bottles, axes, and several hand-blown onion-shaped wine bottles. Chatterton and Matera had seen these artifacts at the lab, pushed off into a corner, stepsisters to Bowden's more glorious finds. Still, they remembered them. Every piece dated to the late 17th century. Not one was a day newer than 1686, the year Bannister did battle with the Royal Navy.
"Guys," Chatterton said, "why can't the sugar wreck be the Golden Fleece?"
The men could see it all in front of them now. Bannister had careened at the island, the most perfect and invisible place in Samana Bay. The Royal Navy tracked him there, but the island's elevation, tight quarters, and dense overgrowth gave the pirates an advantage in battle, and they'd leveraged every bit of it to hold off the Navy warships. Sometime during the fight, or perhaps just after it, the Golden Fleece moved off the island before sinking at this very spot. Perhaps Bannister had tried to get away in her. Or maybe she'd burned her lines and drifted before going under. The three men looked at one another. There was every chance the Golden Fleece was directly under them now. Matera reached for the bottle of beer he'd brought along. He opened it and splashed some over the side. "This is for the dead guys below," he said. Garcia Alacon started the engine and steered back toward shore. On the beach, Chatterton and Matera stood in the surf, happier than either could remember being in a very long time, looking out over their future, looking back at an island that had been there all along. If the world still used telegrams, Chatterton and Matera would have sent one to Bowden asking the critical question, why can't the sugar wreck be the Golden Fleece? They certainly weren't going to do it by phone or email. Only a trip to Santo Domingo to ask Bowden in person could do justice to a question like that. So they drove the wild and bumpy roads back to the Dominican capital city, marveling throughout at Bannister's ingenuity in choosing Cayo Vigia, imagining the sinking hearts on the Royal Navy ships as they took cannon fire from invisible guns mounted high on the unlikeliest island. And what an island it was. By now, Chatterton and Matera had studied it on charts and satellite photos. At its narrowest, it stretched just 38 yards north to south, but it was long and lean, nearly a quarter mile east to west. From the air, Vigia looked like a whale, its muscular front end swooping down into a lean and elegant body, then widening again at the tail, swimming toward the open Atlantic, an island in motion even as it stayed perfectly still. It even had a footbridge. Constructed in the 1960s, the half-mile-long concrete and steel structure connected Cayo Vigia to a resort at the mainland. But few used it.
The island had little beach to speak of and was mostly grown over in trees. Occasionally tourists ventured over, and sometimes amorous couples made an adventure of it, but mostly it was just a dead end. For that reason, the people of Samana called it the Bridge to Nowhere. For Chatterton and Matera, nowhere was the only place that mattered. Every mile they drove, the men grew more eager to see the look on Bowden's face when they told him he already had the Golden Fleece. They didn't doubt he'd ask questions, but they'd prepared answers, fact upon fact that would be hard to argue with, even by someone stuck in his own way. They sat down with Bowden at Adrian Tropical, an upscale cafe in downtown Santo Domingo. Chatterton didn't waste time. "Tracy, let me ask you a question," he said. "Why can't the sugar wreck be the Golden Fleece?" Bowden raised an eyebrow. "Kyovigia is the perfect place to careen a vessel, install shore batteries, and fight the Royal Navy," Chatterton said. "And every artifact you brought up from the sugar wreck is period to Bannister's time." Bowden smiled. Taking a small notebook and a pencil from his shirt pocket, he motioned for the details. The men said they saw it like this. Bannister had careened his ship on a swooning dip on the northern side of Vigia. Tucked into this place, the Golden Fleece became invisible, not just to passing ships, but to the world. The pirates had access to fresh water from a nearby stream. In the channel's calm waters, crewmen hunted turtles and scrubbed their ship's hull without struggle. But Bannister hadn't relaxed. He put two cannon batteries, and probably most of his pirates, into the wooded hills on the island's eastern point. 100 feet above water, these men scanned the horizon with telescopes and sharp eyes, looking for enemies, knowing they could spot trouble hours before trouble found them. After a time, they spied 2 Royal Navy frigates approaching in the distance. Against one, they stood a slight chance. Against both, they would need a miracle. Even then, there was still time to go peacefully. By surrendering now, Bannister could place his fate and that of his men in the hands of a Port Royal jury. But Bannister hadn't come to surrender. Instead, he ordered the pirates to their battle stations. Then he sounded the trumpet and told his men to open fire. Cannonballs and musket shot rained down from the island. To the men on the Navy ships, it must have seemed they'd been attacked by the forest itself. Returning fire, the frigates tacked into the channel near the site of the villa and dropped their anchors, positioning themselves to destroy the Golden Fleece. For 2 days, the battle raged, the pirates leveraging every bit of the island's advantage, the Navy pounding back, until the frigates ran out of powder and shot and, already suffering 23 dead and wounded, turned back for Jamaica. At some point, the Golden Fleece came off the island and, badly damaged, sank less than 200 yards away, right at the site of the sugar wreck. Now Bowden looked thrilled. He scribbled notes. "So what do you think, Tracy?" Matera asked. "Looks like you've had your pirate ship all along. The sugar wreck is really the Golden Fleece." Bowden buttered his toast.
"Bannister really was a hell of a captain," he said. "But you know what? I want to talk about you guys."
And he told Chatterton and Matera they'd done a hell of a job, that they'd showed dedication, creative thinking, and courage, that not many men would have stayed with such a difficult search. And then he told them they were wrong. The sugar wreck, he said, could not be the Golden Fleece, and he began to count off his reasons. Kyovigia is not included in histories that mention the Golden Fleece. Shipwreck hunters have always looked for Bannister's wreck at Cayo Levantado. Many artifacts salvaged from the sugar wreck were intact, unlikely on a ship destroyed in battle. Miss Universe found a period English jar at Cayo Levantado. The sugar wreck site is away from the island, not in a careening place. The French chart refers to Cayo Levantado as Cayo Bonestre. And most important of all, the sugar wreck is too deep.
"Excellent points, Tracy," Chatterton said. Then he spoke to each of Bowden's objections, short and direct.
"It's true that Kyovigia is not included in histories that mention the Golden Fleece, but neither is Cayo Levantado or any other specific location. The crowd is usually wrong. No one knows how much damage the Golden Fleece took. All that's known is that she burned and sank.
The Miss Universe jar could have fallen overboard from a passing ship of the era. The Golden Fleece could have come off the Carine to fight the Navy or attempt an escape. The French chart was drawn up in the early 19th century, more than 100 years after the battle, by people who weren't present for the fight. The Sugar Wreck is of the same period and culture as that of the Golden Fleece. To believe it unrelated to the battle would be, at best, relying on coincidence. Bowden made notes on these points, nodding and saying, "Oh, I see," or, "I hadn't thought about that." Then he pressed the men on the issue of the Sugar Wreck's depth. Men working for treasure hunter William Phipps, he reminded them, had seen the Golden Fleece sunk in 24 feet of water just months after the battle. By contrast, the Sugar Wreck lay in 44 feet. "That's true," Chatterton said. But he noted that Phipps's men never said whether it was 24 feet to the top or the bottom of the wreck. If he meant the top, one would expect the Golden Fleece, broken down by nature over more than 300 years, to be in 44 feet of water, exactly where the Sugar Wreck was. Bowden put down his pencil and told the men they'd done inspired work, and again, he told them they were wrong. The Sugar Wreck was not the Golden Fleece. It would be a good idea to go back to Cayo Levantado and keep searching for her there. Chatterton looked ready to leap across the table and strangle Bowden. So Matera leaned forward and spoke in a measured way, telling Bowden that, with all due respect, there was no way the Golden Fleece was at Cayo Levantado. But before Bowden could answer, Chatterton jumped in. "All you want to do is look where everyone's looked before, Tracy. Where everyone's already been. With that kind of thinking, you're never going to find this wreck. You're never going to find anything." Bowden's face reddened. He looked disturbed by Chatterton's tone, but calmly explained that little about the Sugar Wreck felt right. The depth, the location, the history. "This is not about feelings," Chatterton said. "It's about evidence, hard work, and research."
"That's your opinion," Bowden replied. "No, it's about evidence, hard work, and research. All of the pieces have to fit. I found more than a wreck or two myself, Tracy, important ones. Not once did I do it by feelings or intuition or any other voodoo bullshit."
Both Chatterton and Bowden looked ready to get up and leave, not just the table, but the project. Before that could happen, Matera told Bowden he wanted to discuss another issue and was going to take his chances and speak frankly. "We've got it on good information that other crews might be coming to Levantado to search for the Golden Fleece. As you know, we don't think the wreck's at that island. But sometimes, all it takes is a bullshit story." Bowden nodded. He'd heard people tell those kinds of stories before, but Matera wasn't finished. He also said he'd heard that Cultura was looking to trim down every treasure lease in the country, including Bowden's, and that the agency wanted to bring in new blood. Young guns who could help cover the vast areas that for years had been underworked. Matera judged by Bowden's eyes that he'd heard the same and feared it.
"So what do you suggest I do?" Bowden asked.
"Except that the pirate ship ain't at Levantado," Chatterton said. "It's at Cayo Vigia." "Work the Sugar Wreck," Matera said. "Pull up more artifacts. Prove it's the Golden Fleece." But Bowden didn't look eager to do any of that. If he blew time working at Cayo Vigia and someone else found the Golden Fleece at Cayo Levantado, everything he'd worked for over a lifetime might be tainted. His reputation, his legacy, his honor. And he didn't seem willing to go out like that. Not on a mistake. Not on anything less than sure. Instead, he thought Chatterton and Matera should return to Cayo Levantado and prove conclusively that the Golden Fleece was not there before he committed to another theory. Chatterton jumped up from his seat.
"You're asking us to prove a negative. How can we show you something that's not there?" "Keep looking," said Bowden. "Maybe you missed something. Maybe the mag's not working right."
"What about the 400 other things we found there?" Chatterton said.
"Are you saying we found every goddamn fish trap and license plate around all of Levantado but somehow missed a 100-foot pirate ship?" "We just need to be sure."
Chatterton, ready to explode, stormed off to the restroom.
"Your partner is a hothead," Bowden said. "I don't know if I can work with him anymore."
Matera leaned forward. Listen, Tracy, I've got an idea. Why don't we mag the sugar wreck? Do some serious salvage on her. Come up with proof. It wouldn't take long. But Vodin didn't seem convinced. If claim jumpers were coming, if Kultura was taking back leases, this was not the time to abandon Cayo Levantado, where everyone else would claim the pirate ship sank, and he told Matera that as he paid the check and left for home. When Chatterton returned from the restroom, he didn't even ask where Bowden had gone. Chapter 13. I hope we can stay friends. Chatterton and Matera spent the rest of the day buying supplies in Santo Domingo. Neither spoke of the lunch with Bowden, but each knew what the other was thinking, that this arrangement with the old treasure hunter could not continue. Carolina cooked dinner for them at her apartment. The men steered the conversation away from business, but when she asked how things had gone that afternoon, Chatterton couldn't stay quiet. Bowden, he said, was never going to give up his belief that the Golden Fleece was at Levantado. "The wreck's not there, and I'm not wrong," Chatterton said. "I'm done with this guy." Matera could hardly believe what he was hearing. Chatterton was a lot of things, but he was not a quitter. After dinner, Matera pulled Chatterton into the study where he urged his partner to be patient. "Tracy is a stubborn old man," he said, "but he's not dumb. You've got to let him come to the sugar wreck himself. You've got to let it be his idea, too." That only frustrated Chatterton more, and he let it be known at high volumes. Matera didn't always put up with his partner's yelling, but he knew Chatterton was really yelling at Bowden, and that his partner was right. "Hang in there with me, John," Matera said. "This is not about Tracy." But Chatterton wasn't buying it. To him, Bowden could have been standing inside the lost city of Atlantis, and he wouldn't have believed it if he'd already made up his mind he was somewhere else. After brushing his teeth that night, Matera poured a handful of Advil into his mouth, then washed it down with Mylanta, the same kind of concoction he'd used to endure the 20-hour days at his security company, when a single misstep could have cost him his future. He awoke the next morning to a voicemail message from Bowden, who wanted to talk without Chatterton. "That's it," Matera told Carolina. "Tracy's quitting. He's done with us. The whole thing is falling apart." The two men met for coffee an hour later, but Bowden didn't talk business. Instead, he told Matera about his life. The scuba diving craze hit America in the 1950s, and Bowden found it fast. After graduating from Abington High School near Philadelphia in 1957, he bought his first piece of gear, a wetsuit with a wide yellow stripe that had to be glued on by hand, and headed to the creeks and quarries in the Pocono Mountains. There was little in the way of scuba instruction then. A person tried to teach himself enough to survive, then went underwater to see if it worked out. To make a living, Bowden worked as an apprentice electrician, earning a good salary and with excellent prospects for the future. His mind, however, was on diving, not diodes. When someone told him there were hundreds of shipwrecks off the New Jersey coast, he loaded his car full of gear and didn't stop driving until he got to the ocean. There, he pushed his way into fallen ships. Some of them hadn't been seen since the day they'd gone down. Each year, he added more wrecks to his resume. But he distanced himself from other divers. To him, they were secretive, petty, and cliquey. The same complaints Chatterton would have about the same kinds of people nearly two decades later. So Bowden went it mostly alone. He dreamed of finding something old. Not World War old, but epochs old, from the days that shaped civilizations. But how to do it? There were no classes or instruction manuals for finding those kinds of ships in those days. No mentors looking for protégés. Bowden had to figure things out for himself, and that wouldn't be easy while carrying a full-time job. By now he'd become a master electrician, but more than ever his heart wasn't in it. Even the blueprints he carried to electrical jobs looked like nautical charts to him. In 1969, when Bowden was 30, he told his boss he was taking a 2-week vacation to go look for the HMS DeBrock, an 18th-century shipwreck thought to have sunk at the mouth of the Delaware River and with possible treasure on board.
His boss tried to talk him out of it, but Bowden was already out the door. He didn't find treasure. He didn't even find the wreck. But the rush of having looked stayed with him. In 1976, he set out for the Dominican Republic, where great galleons lay, and was granted exclusive rights to search for ships in a wide-ranging area.